because we got the alternative energy. Right. On nuclear free autonomy.
And welcome to the Radioactive Show, produced at the studios of 3CR Melbourne and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the Radioactive Show. I'm Michaela. On the 11th of March, 15 years ago, a magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami hit the east coast of Japan, triggering a nuclear disaster at the Fukushima power plant, where the backup generators and cooling pumps on 3 reactors loaded with nuclear fuel were destroyed. Vast amounts of radioactive contamination were suddenly released into the environment, and around 150,000 people were forced to evacuate. Today, we're dipping into our archives to bring you one of the first Radioactive Shows broadcast after this nightmare began unfolding. This show was produced and presented by Jesse Boylan on the 26th of March 2011, just 2 weeks after the meltdown.
My home, only in memory. My home stood by the Bay of Ofunato near Hosoura Cove. Just outside the bay lies the Sanriku Sea, with the Pacific Plate hidden underneath. Last Friday, our town of Hosoura was reported as being swept away. Houses, cars and people have been washed away into Ofunato Bay by a violent tsunami. Fires have also broken out. Ofunato is rarely reported outside of Iwate Prefecture, which is known as the Tibet of Japan. Sparsely populated, sleepy little hamlets and towns with beautiful sea views are scattered from north to south along the coast. The area has been known for its beautiful coastline. Everything that existed so close to the epicenter has now gone with the waves. It is so heartbreaking to see the places you grew up in and fondly remember disappear so suddenly. All the familiar places are no longer there. Only distant memories of the places where we played, laughed and cried. No formal means of communication were available, which increased my levels of anxiety and worry. I could not eat nor sleep well, and I even forgot to shower. Frantically, I searched for my relatives' names on the list of evacuees at each evacuation center, using the internet or whatever other means. It was only early Tuesday morning I was informed that my only sister and her husband were alive. It was horrible to check the list of confirmed dead, but I had to do that too. Even though I now know that my sister is alive, the hardship and difficulty she is experiencing is indescribable. At this time of year, it is severely cold in the northeastern part of Japan. It brings tears to my eyes when I think of her situation. The tsunami traveling at 800 kilometers per hour provided around 10 minutes warning to those living directly on the coast facing the earthquake zone. The odds were against the people in my old hometown. Given how close they were to the epicenter, I fear the worst, and for the past few days, I have been preparing myself for the worst. Our family home is gone. But fortunately, my sister is alive and sufficiently far away, 200 kilometers, from harm from the nuclear power plants that are failing. My emotions have been like a yo-yo. I was an unwilling passenger on a roller coaster traveling through the catastrophe. I have never cried as much as I have in the past few days. I grew up with tsunamis and earthquakes. Even having to evacuate with my family in the early 1960s when a 10-meter tsunami hit Ofunato as a result of the Valdivia earthquake in Chile. Since I was a young child, I have known the Pacific Plate lies just outside our bay, but this still does not help me get over this tragedy. Telecommunication company staff have been collecting messages one by one in the devastated areas, then passing them on to the evacuees' relatives by text message once they reach an area with functioning communication systems. This communication provides a level of confidence and comfort to those who have been affected. In contrast, the government reports change hour by hour and day by day, making them unreliable and frustrating to the survivors who are already under unimaginable stress. Now the U.S. rescue team has arrived to help our broken town of Ohinato. In order to move forward, the people who were made homeless in such a harsh climate need your assistance. Please help them however you can. Thank you. So this is my letter, Kimmy Chadwick.
You've tuned in to The Radioactive Show, and this week we look to Japan as the horrifying situation with the Fukushima nuclear power plant is unfolding every minute. What we just heard was a letter written and spoken by Melbourne-based Japanese woman Kimie Chadwick, who is from a town not very far away from Fukushima. On the show this week, we'll hear from a series of experts on the issue, including Dr. Tilman Ruff from the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, who talks about the potentially serious health impacts from radiation exposure. We also speak to Philip White from the Civilian Nuclear Information Center in Tokyo, who gives us an on-the-ground perspective of the situation and the history in relation to nuclear safety regulations in Japan. We also speak to Dave Sweeney from the Australian Conservation Foundation about what this means for Australia. I'm Jessie, and thanks for tuning in. The massive 8.9 magnitude earthquake hit off the northeast coast of Japan on the 11th of March, causing a ravaging tsunami. Although the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi Complex shut down automatically, the tsunami was what managed to break over the walls surrounding the plant and shut down the diesel backup generators, meaning there was a severe lack of electricity which is needed for the reactor cooling system. It is also said that emergency batteries ran out of power soon after as well. The water levels then dropped, causing some of the fuel rods to be exposed to the air, and they couldn't be cooled down fast enough, causing them to degrade, which is what can initiate a meltdown. Also, a build-up of hydrogen as a result of the fuel rods reacting with steam from the plant has led to multiple explosions, causing more danger. Authorities and engineers are right now trying different measures to cool the reactors down. This is their most immediate task in order to prevent a meltdown and further explosions. We talked to Philip White from the Citizens Nuclear Information Center in Tokyo, who gives us a better perspective on the situation in Japan and some history to all this.
The last I've heard, they haven't extended the area of 20 kilometres around the plant that they are evacuating, and there was a further 10 kilometres out, 30 kilometres, where they're suggesting people stay inside. If it is true that they haven't extended that area, then it's just, to me, incomprehensible. It's not just a matter of what are the radiation doses now. The government has been very reactive, looking at the radiation doses now and what are the effects on health now. I haven't been entirely frank about that either, but you've got to be planning for the next step. I mean, this thing is totally out of control. There are six power plants there lined up in a row, three of them at least with a full load of fuel, and all of them with spent fuel pools that are going up. Some of them are going up in smoke, and they could all go up. The quantity of radioactivity involved there just dwarfs that in Chernobyl. The difference, should I say. I mean, we don't know where it's all going to end up, but it's a matter of how far it gets spread, and that'll depend on how much explosive force it goes up with and how much force in the fire. There's no graphite there to burn as in Chernobyl, so it might not go so far, but it certainly potentially can get out quite a long way in the atmosphere and be carried on the winds.
Right.
And so you've got to have that in mind when you plan your evacuation areas. But I must add one qualification to that. And the important thing to realise about this accident and disaster is that it's a nuclear disaster combined with an earthquake and tsunami disaster, which means the infrastructure has been largely wiped out. And they're trying to evacuate people from all around the north of Japan for other reasons. So there's tremendous stress on the whole system. So what is logistically possible? I don't know.
You've been in Japan for a total of 16 years since 1987. Just wondering if you can give us a little bit of a background on the nuclear safety monitoring regulations in Japan.
Back in the early days, and in fact up until the end of the 90s, the promoter of nuclear power and the regulator of nuclear power were one and the same body. And this led to all sorts of problems and very, very lax monitoring of safety standards, which was a major reason for, until this, the previously the most severe nuclear accident that occurred in Japan, when a uranium conversion facility went critical, as they say, and released neutrons and other radioactivity into the environment. And it was necessary to clear the region around there for, well, 300 meters was the distance they evacuated. But that was in a place where there were people living. Then they decided that, yes, you needed to separate these two functions, but they only went halfway. They separated them into two agencies, one dealing with regulation and one promoting nuclear power, but they kept them under the same ministry. So in the end, the same ministry and the same minister is responsible for both promoting nuclear power and regulating it. The International Atomic Energy Agency itself contains that contradiction, and it's a big problem. But the IAEA recommendations are that you do separate these functions, and Japan has not effectively done that.
Right. And what about TEPCO, the company running Fukushima? What are their safety regulations?
Well, their safety practices have been very lax in many ways, particularly their secrecy and covering up problems and even falsifying data led to a major scandal back in 2002 and the following year, where all 17 of TEPCO's reactors were closed down because of the outrage at this cover-up. And interestingly enough, there were no blackouts during that period. So in fact, with all of TEPCO's nuclear power plants offline, it was still possible to keep the power supply. But this time, there's a different factor in that it's not just nuclear power plants. There's also fossil fuel plants and hydro plants and the like have been affected by the earthquake and tsunami. So there are lots of blackouts. But anyway, as for TEPCO's history, that's the sort of organisation that it has been, and it's not trusted.
Yeah. What do you think this may mean for Japan in terms of nuclear power in the future?
It's hard to imagine new power plants being built in Japan after this. The governor of Yamaguchi Prefecture has already called upon the company that was preparing to build a power plant down in Kaminoseki, which is an ecologically very sensitive area. But that's not a final cancellation of the project, but I imagine that there's a very good chance that that'll be the end result. Then you look at plants that are already being constructed, and there are a couple of those under construction, and it'd be interesting to see what happens with them. Plants that are already operating, well, these ones have been wiped out, so I don't think we'll see them again. But the rest of them, there will be calls, and there are already calls to shut them down, particularly some of the most sensitive ones. I mean, any nuclear power plant in Japan is at risk of a major earthquake, but there are a couple that are particularly sensitive, like, for example, Hamaoka, which is right on the point where three plates, seismic plates, geological plates, whatever you call them, intersect. So, I mean, it's a potential site of an earthquake of the scale of the one that we've just experienced. So there'll be a lot of pressure for those to close down. Can they shut them all down? Well, I just described that in the case of TEPCO, when TEPCO shut them all down, they got by. But in the long term, or the medium term, should I say, I imagine that there will be a strong view that we have to keep them going just to keep the electricity supply going for the time being, and we have to wear the risk. There will be a lot of people think like that. But I think the common ground between those who think they should be stopped immediately and those who think that in that case we'd have an even worse power situation is that they should be at least aiming to phase them out over a period of time, and the faster the better, and bring in alternatives in particular.
Do you think the leadership in Japan will take this initiative from here in terms of seeking alternatives?
I think there's very little chance that the leadership of Japan will take the initiative. The question is whether this will the public force it to follow through and close down plants and phase out nuclear power and introduce alternatives. I think public pressure is the only thing that will change them. And the question is whether or not this accident is going to mobilize enough public opinion and public action to force the government and the electric power companies to change their direction.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Radioactive Show, produced in the studios of 3CR Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. We've just been hearing an interview with Philip White from the Citizens Nuclear Information Centre in Tokyo. Philip said that although there's been lots of concern about the nuclear reactors in the past, he wonders if this will prompt the Japanese people to stop thinking about this as a necessary evil and whether or not they can do without. Let's hear an interview now with Dr. Tilman Ruff from the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, who talks about the serious health impacts that this will have on civilian and workers' health. Thanks, Tilman, for being on the Radioactive Show with us this week. I was just wondering if you can give us a little bit of an update as to the health impact on the citizens and workers of Japan at this stage.
It's really an extraordinarily difficult and tragic situation where they're confronting a massive humanitarian disaster compounded by an avoidable nuclear emergency. And responding to the nuclear emergency, of course, is much more difficult when there's been so much disruption of transport, power, communications, water, all of the things that are needed to try and deal effectively with this nuclear emergency. We know that there have been some significant releases from the plants already, that there have been explosions at now four of the Fukushima plants, that two of the primary containment vessels, the reinforced concrete and stainless steel structures around the reactor vessels at numbers two and three reactors are damaged. We know that the spent fuel ponds that are just next to the reactors in the same building that contain actually more radioactivity than is in the reactor cores have had serious problems with cooling, and if they're exposed to the air, there really is a major risk of a fire, and they don't have any containment structures around them at all. So it's a really complex, evolving, unstable, utterly unprecedented situation. You know, we've never been here before with such extensive damage to multiple reactors at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
For the workers who are on the site, the radiation exposures will be quite significant. And in fact, the Japanese government has already increased up to 250 millisieverts, the usual maximum allowed dose for workers of 100 millisieverts per year.
Wow.
Which in Japan is already quite a lot higher than the 20 millisieverts per year that's applied in most other countries, including Australia.
Mm-hmm. And what can we expect to see from here? I mean, it's obviously still unfolding and information is still being disseminated. Are we getting the right information that we need, or are we still sort of unclear as to exactly what is happening on the ground there?
I think we're certainly getting some information, but it's been fragmented and somewhat inconsistent and certainly not necessarily complete or timely. The Japanese Prime Minister himself has expressed great frustration with Tokyo Electric Power Company not notifying the government about major developments at the site. This morning, the United States Regulatory Commission staff in Japan identified the problem of spent fuel ponds at number three plant that were completely exposed that we hadn't heard from a Japanese source. And unfortunately, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, as with all of the other major power operators in Japan, have a pretty unsavoury history, really, of cover-up and data falsification in relation to safety records and important safety monitoring of the plants.
Mm.
So we're certainly getting some important information, but it's hard to know how complete it is, and there are clearly frustrations by many about the lack of information.
And what is the potential sort of longevity of the radiation after effects of this kind of disaster?
They're potentially really long. You know, the main, what comes out of a nuclear reactor if there's a significant breach or a fire in the spent fuel ponds is a cocktail of hundreds of different radioactive chemicals with very different properties and periods over which they're hazardous. We usually measure how fast they decay by the half-life.
Mm-hmm.
So a very short half-life of seconds or minutes means after that period of time there's half the original amount of material left.
Mm-hmm.
After that time again there's a quarter of the original amount left, and so on. So some of these materials have half-lives in the seconds and minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Others, like iodine-131, has a half-life of 8 days, so it will decay quite substantially over a period of a few months. And others like cesium, which was the major contaminant following the Chernobyl disaster, have half-lives of 30 years.
Right.
So, you know, that's a continuing issue, so that the exclusion zone around Chernobyl of 30 kilometres where people can't live or grow food, you know, will be off limits for probably a couple of centuries.
Wow.
And then you've got very long-lived isotopes like plutonium with a half-life of 24,000 years, which will be around for extremely long periods. And that, I have to say, is a particular concern in relation to this accident, because at the number three plant, late last year, for the first time, they loaded that plant with what's called MOX fuel, mixed oxide fuel. So it's not just uranium fuel, but it includes plutonium. Now, plutonium is normally produced in the nuclear fuel as it undergoes fission in the reactor. That's just part of the process. So at the end of its life in the reactor, the fuel has about 1 or 2% plutonium. But the fuel that they're putting into this reactor, number three, that went in late last year, already has around 6% of plutonium in it. So the plutonium contamination issues from that reactor are potentially would exacerbate the situation.
All right. Well, thank you, Tillman. I won't keep you any longer. Thanks for being with us on the Radioactive Show today. It's all very sad and shocking what's going on in Japan at the moment, and obviously all of our thoughts are with people in Japan at this stage.
Indeed.
You're listening to the Radioactive Show, and we've been hearing an interview from Dr. Tillman Ruff from the Medical Association for the Prevention of War. Now let's hear from Australian Conservation Foundation's National Nuclear Free Campaigner Dave Sweeney on the issue of Australia's role in all of this and where we can go from here.
Thanks for being on the Radioactive Show with us this week, Dave.
Pleasure, Jess. Thanks for the opportunity.
So, Dave, as the situation unfolds in Japan, how can we look back at Australia's role in all this?
Well, it's deeply disturbing, the situation in Japan, and every bit of news gets worse, which is really tragic. So, obviously, all our hearts and thoughts are with the people there. And if there's one thing that can and should come out of this terrible situation, it's a review and a reflection about Australia's role and the role internationally of involvement in the nuclear industry. I think, Jess, in relation to Australia, that should come in three parts. Draw a line now, absolutely, underneath this ridiculous talk, increasingly ludicrous talk about domestic nuclear power in Australia. We haven't got it. We should never have it. We are blessed in this country with a range of renewable resources. We're a small population, a smart population, a rich country. We don't need to go down the discredited and dirty path of nuclear. We should be a platform for the development, the commercialisation, the export of clean energy technologies. So number one, all the political figures should just say, look, we're not having nuclear power in this country. We haven't got it now. We're not going to take it on. Japan has showed us what it really means when the face comes off the beast, and we are going to commit to being a serious provider and player in the world of renewables, the fastest growing energy source. The other thing I think for Australia is that we need to look at the costs and the consequences. We need to look at the risks and the threats of our supplying uranium to reactors around the world and to a growing number of countries around the world.
Absolutely.
And it's very interesting that we haven't heard for a week from BHP Billiton or from Rio Tinto or from the Australian Uranium Association or from Minister Martin Ferguson, all of whom bang the drum long and hard and talk up the prospects and the potential and the profits of Australian uranium sales. But when something goes wrong, and something has gone horribly wrong this week, they are completely missing in action. We need to look at what it means to be a country that has 40% of the world's uranium, the biggest single reserve, and supplies 20% of the world's market. Because what we are doing is, on a good day, we're creating radioactive waste. On a bad day, we're creating fallout. We need to look at, are we happy to be a quarry to push this contaminating and contested fuel source around the world? I think the third area, Jess, that we need to look at in Australia is we need to look at the issues of responsibility and transparency in relation to the management of the waste that we already have here. That's particularly pertinent now because around this time now, we are seeing Minister Ferguson pushing through a draconian, a heavy-handed piece of legislation which stripped the rights of communities, local governments, states and territories, and above all, Aboriginal people, and attempts to impose a radioactive waste dump on the Northern Territory. Now, if there's one thing that we've seen out of Japan, it's the importance of community confidence, it's the importance of disclosure, it's the importance of transparency. None of those things none of those things are happening in relation to how Australia is currently shaping up to manage radioactive waste, and that should change. So there's things we need to learn at home, there's things we need to change at home, and there's things we need to learn internationally. And one of the key things is that this industry is a high-cost, high-risk industry. They've spent a lot of money and a lot of time over the past decade, the nuclear industry, refashioning themselves and repositioning themselves as a so-called solution to climate change. Well, they're not. This industry on a good day creates radioactive waste. On a bad day creates radioactive fallout that spews uncontained and uncontainable across communities. It is not the basis for a clean energy system. It is not the basis for a smart or sustainable energy future. And if there is one good thing that could come from a series of very ugly things in Japan this week and in the coming days and months, it's that this needs to be, as the German Chancellor has said, a turning point. We can't continue business as usual. We have to get rid of our involvement in the nuclear trade. The uranium industry is where the nuclear industry starts. It is the fuel for this disaster, this uncertainty and this threat. And it's time that Australia turned off the toxic tap.
You've been listening to The Radioactive Show, and that was Dave Sweeney from the Australian Conservation Foundation talking about Australia's role in the toxic nuclear chain. This show was recorded on Thursday, the 17th of March.
We've just been listening to A Radioactive Show, first broadcast on the 26th of March 2011, just a couple of weeks after the Fukushima nuclear disaster began. 15 years later, the impacts of that dreadful day are still very real, with cleanup expected to take at least another 40 years. Thomas Bass writes in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, 4,000 workers struggled to control the ongoing disaster. The three melted reactors remain so radioactive that they destroy the robots sent to explore the damage. No one knows exactly where the melted fuel is located or how deep it is burrowed below the reactor's concrete pedestals, possibly into the ground. The water used to cool the reactors is stored in more than 1,000 tanks that reached capacity in 2023. This cooling water, which TEPCO initially claimed was clean, was found to be contaminated with 62 radionuclides, including cesium, strontium, and plutonium. 1.3 million tons of contaminated water is still at the site, and radioactive wastewater is now being pumped into the Pacific Ocean. You can find this article and more information about the disaster at thebulletin.org. Thanks so much to Jesse Boylan for producing that show, and to Sam Givard for digitizing the archives. Now for a few events happening this weekend. The Pacific Peace Network is holding an emergency webinar on the war on Iran and the impacts for our Blue Pacific. It's at 11 a.m. Brisbane time and midday in Melbourne, and you can hear from speakers across the Pacific about the potential impacts of the US-Israel war on Iran, Lebanon and Gaza, and ways to act for peace. And you can go to actquakers.org.au to find all the details of that event. For our listeners in Melbourne, you can attend a workshop, Help Sink AUKUS Before It Sinks Us, from 1 to 3pm today at the Maritime Union of Australia, 46 Island Street, West Melbourne. And that's organised by the No AUKUS Coalition Vic, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, and Spirit of Eureka. On Sunday the 15th of March, come to the State Library of Victoria. At midday, the Free Palestine Coalition NAM are holding a commemoration, 7 years since the Christchurch massacre, that saw 51 Muslims killed by an Australian Islamophobic anti-immigration fascist. Followed at 1 p.m. by a mass anti-war protest against the US-Israeli imperialist war on Iran. Join millions around the world calling for an immediate end to the US-Israeli war on the Middle East and West Asia region. Stand with Palestine and the people of Lebanon and Iran. Stand for the freedom of the land and people from the boots of Zionist colonialism, US imperialism, and capitalist dictatorship. Well, thanks so much for listening. The Radioactive Show is produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio on unceded Kulin land with the support of the Nuclear Free Collective at Friends of the Earth Melbourne and is distributed across the continent thanks to the Community Radio Network. You can find this and all our podcasts at 3cr.org.au/radioactive. Thanks for listening and join us again next week for more news and views on nuclear peace and energy issues.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.